Welcome to Ventec FM, a series of podcasts where we focus on various aspects of the coffee and vending world. Sounds fun, right? Alongside the suppliers, customers, and everyone else in between, we'll give you a unique look at what we're about and what's truly important in an ever-changing and surprisingly interesting industry. Today's episode is turning the COVID corner. Are FM companies getting the support they need? Intelligent, informative, insightful, innovative, and independent is IFM, the first and still the best online resource of information about facilities management. This is a big and dynamic industry. It can also be pretty confusing. We're here to help you understand it and prosper in it. Whether you're an in-house practitioner, a service provider, or a newcomer to the whole strange business, with two decades of accessible and searchable archives, no other resource is as comprehensive or as authoritative. Today's guest is IFM's Managing Director, David Emmanuel. He's here to talk about the support or lack of that the facilities management companies get and to see post-COVID what help they actually need to get back on track. Hello, David.
Hi, thank you very much. What a fantastic intro.
Thank you. Welcome along. Who's David Emmanuel?
Who is David Emmanuel? So I'm the founder and the MD of IFM, as you already mentioned. Yeah. It's an online news and information resource. I'm the proud father of two daughters. I'm a liveryman. I'm the webmaster for the Wershall Company of Pattern Makers. I'm a court assistant to them as well. I've done my time on volunteering as well within the industry.
Yep.
So I have been a director of the Facilities Management Association, board director. I've been a board director of the IFMA UK chapter. And I've also done two terms on the Members Council for, as was BIFM, now IWFM,
yeah.
And was also the treasurer for the Women in FM Special Interest Group for IWFM.
Wow.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Tell me about IFM.
So IFM's was developed in the last century.
Yeah.
And I'm proud of that because we're kind of recognised as being pioneers.
Yeah.
My background was publishing.
Yeah.
And I kind of always thought to myself, by the time anyone picks up a magazine, it's out of date.
Yeah.
You know, especially if it's news. Articles, interviews, comments, that doesn't really make much difference.
Yeah.
A couple of weeks here and there. But a lot of it had news sections and it was really out of date. So we wanted to build something that was more immediate. So
yeah.
In 1999, we created this platform that delivered the news to people's desktops on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I mean, 2021 now, 21 years ago, it's hard to believe, but people didn't have desktop internet access. They didn't have email access on their desk, on the desktop. Of course, everyone now has it on their phone. And I remember when one of the tech guys was messing around with his phone, and I went over to him. I said, Jacob, what are you doing? He said, I'm testing the site out on my phone. I said, what do you mean you're testing it on your phone? He said, well, I'm trying to see if I can get it to deliver the content on a phone. And I said, really? I mean, you know, back then it was WAP. It wasn't, that's what the technology was.
Yeah.
Anyway, he did it. And I said, oh, Jacob, I said, it's clever, but no one's going to do that. Well, of course, I eat my words because, looking at mobile devices, that's how people, and tablets, that's how they primarily access the site these days.
Yeah.
So the site was there primarily to do what I thought magazines couldn't, be sustainable. I've always thought that printing on paper and chopping down trees wasn't really the solution.
Yeah.
And also the fact that we had a more immediate way of delivering news and information to people.
Yeah.
So it's a combination of a trade magazine and really research and resources, because we've done an awful lot of research and surveys. And we like to create reports and try and keep people updated. What are the trends that are going on within the sector?
Yeah, it is brilliant. It's such a great resource. It's kind of, if you need something or you need to find something out, it's in there somewhere.
Do you know what? I think the interesting thing is, of course, with magazines, some people do. They have a whole collection of them and they're there on their shelves. But, if you've read an article, you've read a piece of news and you want to refer back to it, and you ever find that blooming copy or that edition that was there? So that's I'm constantly use the search engine on our own site because, memory's going a bit. And I think, I know we wrote something about this. Now, well, who was it? What did they say? And boom, you can go back 20 years and find something that somebody has said. And interestingly, we've just written a piece about the whole sector over a 20-year period. And we've done one that was 10 years. And I was looking back at an article that somebody had written, and it was about 20 years ago, And what he said still stood the test of time.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting. You could just pull that up, reread it, and it transcended time.
Yeah.
I mean, what he was saying back then still sounded true today.
Yeah.
So whilst we have advanced a hell of a lot, there are so many things that are exactly the same.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we'll come on to a few of the issues in the marketplace that...
Absolutely brilliant. And what changes are FM companies facing now?
Well, I was thinking about this and I was thinking, well, it's actually all the R's. Recognition, respect, recruitment and retention, reward, i.e. the lack of margins, the lack of profitability in some cases, and the race to the bottom.
Yeah.
So commoditization. So all the things beginning with R, they happened. They were there 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure we've actually solved all of them now either. Of course, we've created an awful lot of extra issues on ourselves. I think that the way that we look at buildings and the built environment is very much different. You know, we used to look at buildings and the FM was about the building. Well, actually, we now really recognise it's actually about the well-being of the occupants of the building, not just about the bricks and mortar.
Yes. Yeah.
Of course, FMs are managing, you know, all the HVAC, the plant, the equipment, but really we're there to support the occupants.
Yeah.
So we've got that added complexity in terms of our workload. And also, I think that where the real shift is happening nowadays is about sustainability. So, of course, FMs Absolutely. Are managing waste, energy management, the use of plastics, the use of products that are harmful. So we've got this whole environmental aspect going on. And I think that's kind of summed up nowadays with companies that have to do reports on ESG, environmental sustainability and governance.
Yep.
And of course, I think this is a big area for FMs. I think we're going to be very much more... leading the way, advising our clients as to, you know, the best policies in terms of, you know, that can be about waste management, it can be about energy usage, it can be about using better products and packaging, it can also be about, you know, the LED lights. And so I think to summarise that, one of the biggest issues that FM faces is that it's used to try and reduce the bottom line costs. And actually what FM should really be used for is to improve service quality and well-being of the building occupants.
Yeah.
And I think that we're starting to see that happen now, but historically that hasn't been the case.
Yeah, yeah. And do you think the changes, end of restrictions, will start to make things better for facilities management?
I do hope so. I think the whole problem, if you look at facilities management and the workplace, is has the workplace actually changed during the pandemic? So what we've seen from all the research, especially from Leisman, is that the average home is outperforming the average workplace. So people aren't wanting to return back to the office because they're happier, but not everybody. And this is again, it's polarized people. As to whether or not their home is set up for working from home or not.
Yeah.
And I think that what we're seeing is that, you know, a lot of organisations thought that they'd have their workers back in their offices by now.
Yeah.
And they really haven't.
Yeah.
You know, people are still choosing to stay at home. But I also think that one of the things that we always forget is it's not just about offices. You know, FM is involved in hospitals, universities, schools, transportation. Industrial manufacturing, there's such a huge amount of places that FMs are working, and you know, it doesn't really matter what the purpose, whether it's work, rest or play, it's still about the work, the well-being of those occupants using that space.
Absolutely. And there's even been sites that pretty much had to carry on anyway during the pandemic.
There are
hospitals as an example.
Exactly.
Things have changed there, but they still carried on.
I think the pandemic polarized the whole sector. There were those that did nothing and were furloughed, and those that were working twice as hard and were burning themselves out. And of course, FMs were there. You know, they had to run the buildings. You can't just leave a building unattended. Yeah. So I know that there are buildings where people have, and they've ignored the advice, and they're going to return back to find they've got Legionnaires or Legionella in because they haven't run the water through the pipes. It's basic, simple things like that.
Yeah.
That can really, you know, affect a building.
Yeah. Yeah. It's important. Do FM companies get the support and help they should or need?
I think during the pandemic, the government really did help an awful lot of FM companies and their employees.
Yeah.
So I don't think we've ever seen anything quite like the furlough scheme.
No.
And that obviously has saved millions of jobs.
Yeah,
I agree. I think that there has been things like VAT deferments. There have been CBIL loans. There has been PAY deferments. All of these things have helped keep organisations stay solvent.
Yeah.
I asked at the AGM for the IWFM, if it wasn't for the 193,000 that they deferred in PAYE, the 76,000 they had in furlough, and the £100,000 they took in a CBIL loan, would they still be solvent? Didn't want to answer that question, and they answered it that they were in a position far better than they could have been.
Right.
But I think the answer is, without it, they would have been insolvent by now.
Yeah.
So, yes, I think the government's really helped out. Has the IWFM really helped them? No, I don't think they did. You know, the opening gambit was that they could have mothballed the organisation and put everybody on furlough and waited for it all to end.
Right.
I think that's a peculiar way to look at the first response.
Yeah.
I don't think they did enough prior to the pandemic, let alone enough during the pandemic to help their membership. And I think that what we've seen with the IWFM, unfortunately, is that their membership and their turnover has fallen quite drastically. I think they said that in 2020's accounts, it was down 18% on the year before. Membership has fallen again. I think one of the problems with the Institute is they're not particularly transparent and open. And if you ask them for figures, they start telling you about rolling membership figures average for the year. So when you ask them, well actually, what's your membership today? They don't give you a straight answer. They say, well, over the last year, we've had, but at the end of the day, for the last couple of years, they've lost, well, they used to be proudly saying that they had about 17,500.
Yeah.
Whether they've got 12,000 today, whether they've got less than that, it's quite unclear, but they've dropped an awful lot.
Yeah.
That's for sure. And I think the reason is because they're offering value. So membership starts at £150. If you look at their trade magazine, I've got to say, you know, their trade mag facilitate is superb.
Yep.
Their editor is superb. But it's gone from being fortnightly to then it went to monthly to then it's gone every other month. And what we've now seen is that the IWFM have cut costs and said, well, only professional grade members will receive the magazine.
Right.
So if you're an associate or an affiliate and you're still paying £150 a year, you're no longer getting the magazine. And they're saying, well, you won't get a hard copy magazine, but you can get the digital edition.
Right.
I think that's a bit mean.
Yeah.
And I think that the one core benefit that you receive from the Institute is that magazine.
That magazine, yeah.
So I think it's a bit tough what they're doing there.
Yeah.
You know, I think that once you've paid your joining fee and then you pay your annual membership, you're just at the beginning of the journey to pay. You don't get anything else for free. You want to attend their conference, they charge you. You want to attend their awards dinner, they charge you.
Yeah.
And I think the awards dinner, I think they said that the premium tables were $4,000 for a table.
Wow.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think what you'll find is that most of the people that attend the awards dinner, which is next Monday, the guests are service providers. They're not in-house practitioners. The in-house practitioner cannot afford to take a seat at the... there are seats, but most people take tables. But I don't think they can afford to go. They're priced out. So 90% of the people there aren't members of the Institute anyway.
Yeah. So what should they be doing to...
Well,
help.
I think the Institute sort of transformed itself from an institute to a training provider and a qualification and also an accrediting body.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a bit of a problem with that. So they used to outsource that and have a joint venture with a company called Quadrilect, and that was called BIFM Training. And then they decided to bring that in-house and do it themselves directly. There are other training providers out there that are superb, like Zenon. And I think the issue is, you know, if you're devising the accreditation, you shouldn't be doing the actual training. You should focus on the accreditation, not the actual training. It's makes a bit sense. Like saying in a game of football that the goalkeeper's the referee. I just don't think it works. So I think it should be doing more lobbying. I think it should really be getting out there and encouraging people to come into the industry. Or the profession. So obviously part of what they're trying to achieve is to professionalize FM. One of their missions is to become, to get chartered status. Well, ever since I've known them, which was, I think it was 1995, they've been talking about chartership. And they've never pursued it. They've always had a watching brief on it. Now they say they've got an active strategy to pursue it. Well, the reason, in my opinion, is that it was a watching brief is because they never had the resources or the actual the chances or the likelihood of actually receiving it. I think, first of all, I think there are other trade organisations or chartered organisations that would oppose them to the Privy Council, and the Privy Council would have to listen to people like RICS. I think, secondly, they're looking for organisations that are solvent and have a strong financial history. Now, IWFM has not made a profit since 2017. Their reserves are down to something like 70,000. When I was on the Members' Council, they had nearly £500,000 of reserves for just such problems like COVID. You know, unexpected. That's the reason they put that money behind them. So I don't think the Privy Council is going to say, well, you're financially secure. I think other people will oppose it. And I think the other problem is that only 54% of their members are actually of a professional grade. All the rest are associates and affiliates. Well, if they want to become chartered, I think they're going to have a much higher proportion that have got qualifications. So, yes, I think it's important to encourage everyone to get qualifications. But I don't think they should be delivering the training to get them. I think they should let other people do that. I think where their focus should be is encouraging people into the industry. I think it's always said, oh, I fell into FM. You know, I was from hospitality, or I was in cleaning, or I was this, that, or the other. I want it to be a career of choice. I want kids to say, oh, well, I don't want to be a train driver or a racing driver. I'd like to be a facilities manager. That's what we've got to try and convince. So I think we've got to go out to primary schools, secondary schools, possibly too late by the time you've got to university, but why not? Go in there, do the milk rounds. Try and get that last opportunity to convince people that actually this is quite an exciting profession to be in. And that not only are you helping the well-being of the people in the buildings that you're managing, but you're also helping society and the planet at the same time. So I think that message needs to be delivered, and I think they should be doing it. I think it's very unfortunate that the FMA went into administration some years ago, because they truly were the natural voice of FM. And I don't think IWFM is, you know, they've always said they're there to represent the practitioner or the professional and getting qualifications. And it surprises me that they have so many corporate members that are members. Because they get even less value than anybody else. But I do think that they're starting to realise that. And I think that part of the groups that have stopped paying the money are the corporates, because they do receive very little back from it. I also think government needs to be lobbied and communicated with. I think that it's changing. I think that they've changed their playbook. You know, they outsource about £290 million a year into the sector. I know that they want to try and encourage a third of that into the SME sector. And we'll have to wait and see whether that actually happens. Certainly a lot of the big contracts that went out to the larger service providers in terms of building the Nightingale Hospitals, for example, which I have to say is probably the one time that service providers have actually collaborated and worked together for a common goal.
Yeah.
And have done absolutely phenomenal jobs.
Yeah.
I think COVID has really shone a spotlight on the whole sector and industry. And I think where people didn't really understand what a facilities manager was, I think they're starting to get a better appreciation of that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that we still truly understand it. I think we're still looking very much at health and safety, and cleaning and security as being FM. And I think FM's so much wider than that.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think there is that kind of lack of knowledge almost, that people don't realise how much facilities management companies actually do.
And agreed.
What they contribute to our business.
A very good friend of mine, Martin Pickard, who is our conference chair at Workplace Features, he created something called the mind map, or the FM mind map.
Right.
And it shows every tentacle that FM is involved with.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, you need an A3 plotter to really plot it. And even then you need a magnifying glass to see every little thread and link. We're involved in so much of what's going on.
Yeah. It is surprising. There is that kind of lack of knowledge, I think, generally, that people don't realise how much FM companies actually contribute and do within a business kind of thing. We do think of all the obvious stuff like security, health and safety, even catering to a level. How can they be helped more? How can they help FM companies?
So I think the problem is that, as I said, COVID showed how good we've managed to collaborate. And I don't think that we've managed to do that prior to that. And I do believe that there really is a requirement for a trade association. Yeah. And I think that trade association should be there as a think tank.
Yeah.
It should be there looking at best practices, and it should work together to help all service providers and all FMs, do the best job that they possibly can and create excellence.
Yeah.
So I kind of think that would be helpful to be put back in place.
Yeah. I agree. and obviously, I mean, because from my experience, a lot of FM companies, they pretty much break even. They don't tend to make loads of profit as a business as a whole. From a support side on that, is that just because it's so tight on the margins in terms of bidding for a tender, going for a contract? Is that always going to be the case, or do you think that can change as well?
I mean, I mentioned it at the beginning, the race to the bottom and the commoditization.
Yeah.
No, FM is primarily a service.
Yeah.
And I think it's very difficult to try and commoditize a service. I remember that reverse auctions were a thing. Thank goodness they're not anymore.
Yeah.
We were helping a client, and they were bidding for a contract, and basically the price kept going down and down and down.
Yeah.
And they kept saying, "No, we want this. We want this contract." And I was looking at them saying, "But at any cost?"
Yeah.
And they said, "Yeah, but it's good. It's a good brand to have on board."
Yeah.
And basically,
but then it, yeah.
So they've a lot of FM companies have done it to themselves.
Yeah.
Some of them just need a lot, need to put a lot of meat into the sausage machine to churn it out.
Yeah.
They've got to keep their staff busy. And I think that actually that's not really the most intelligent way of going forward.
No.
You really need to look at the opportunities, look where you're going to be able to add the most value.
Yeah.
And make the most margin.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if you can make more margin, you'll be able to put back into that contract things like innovation that you just won't if you haven't got the margin to do so.
Yeah.
So I think it's a win-win-win for everybody. If you actually have slightly higher margins, companies make more profitability and they can sort of reinvest that back in.
Yeah.
So I think technology is going to be a huge game changer.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
However, who's going to pay for it?
Yeah, yeah. It's got to be paid for, hasn't it?
It needs to be paid for. So why would the service providers pay for it if the client's not willing to pay for it?
Yeah.
They're not. So there has to be an appreciation that, with efficiencies comes investment.
Yeah.
And I think that there needs to be slightly longer term contracts.
Yeah.
I think three is still the magic number in terms of contract terms.
Yeah.
And it really isn't long enough.
Yeah.
We need 5 year and we need five plus agreed. Twos.
Yeah.
And we need rolling contracts. Because if you're working well and you're culturally aligned and you know you are helping the people within the organization, why change and risk it?
Yeah.
For just a little less money.
Yeah.
It seems a very foolish thing to do, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And I also think that we've seen a spate of insourcing as well. And I kind of think that, again, it's all about cost cutting.
Yeah.
You know, they fail to be able to know what the service is that they require. And then when they're not getting what they want at the cost that they want, they think they can do it better themselves in-house.
Yeah.
And slice out a bit of management layer. And the answer is they can. But actually, they're not going to improve.
Yeah.
So the quality actually goes down.
Yeah.
And in around 5 years' time, they're going to look and go, well, actually, where are we compared to the market? Let's have a look. And the market has accelerated beyond them.
Yeah.
And then they're going to outsource again.
Yeah.
They would have been better off just working out what it was they wanted as a service requirement.
Yeah.
And sticking to that.
Yeah.
And I think we've got problems with KPIs. You know, they're key performance indicators. And people get a whole long list of them. Well, actually, they should be more succinct. So if you can better identify what it is that you expect of your service provider, they've got a much better chance of actually delivering it for you.
Yeah, 100%. It does seem like a vicious circle, doesn't it? You've got obviously everyone wants the best price, everyone wants, but it almost becomes like say the race to the bottom where the cheapest one wins kind of thing, and so many companies just want that business, they want the contract, especially with big names and big brands they want to be associated with, but then almost run things at a loss or a
agreed. And you know, there are a number of organizations that have done that to their detriment.
Yeah.
And it's not the sensible way forward.
Yeah. You're almost willing to lose a bit of money on a contract to keep
to try and attract other people in. I think there's also that other thing we're saying, well, we'll go in at this price. And then with some clever variations over the term of the contract, we'll make that money back.
Yeah.
But they don't always.
No, it doesn't.
And therefore, you know, if you can't get that variation through and you know, and imagine going to a client saying, well, you know, we've just won the tender. Brilliant. We've mobilized. Oh, you want us to do that? Oh, I'm afraid that's extra.
Yeah.
Doesn't create the best will, does it?
No, it doesn't. And then it impacts the contract renewal at a later date. If you've provided a really good service at a really good price, then you've got a better chance of keeping that contract or getting rolling or extended contracts if we're doing 5+2s and things like that. But obviously you can't do that if you're promising stuff at the beginning and then having to tweak it and change it as you go along. And it is, like I say, it is that vicious circle, I think, for a lot of the FM companies where they get in that trap where they just win the business and want to keep the business and just go around in circles almost.
It's very interesting. So a good friend of mine, Mike Kent, he's spoken at our conference a few times and I think his overall message, and he's won, I can't remember, the PNFM Awards, you know, he's won the highest accolade of being an FM that's done the most for the industry.
Yeah.
And he's always said, you know, FM's not rocket science. It's not rocket science. It's not brain surgery.
Yeah.
He said, yeah, it's not that complicated. Why are we trying to overcomplicate things?
Yeah.
So if we try and keep things a little bit more simple, I think we might stand a better chance.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And that simplicity does help. I think the key, I suppose, is almost the expectations of the client need to almost shift a little bit to expect realistic pricing, and realistic kind of levels.
And I think, you know, there was once this terminology of the intelligent client. And I think that kind of upset an awful lot of other people that were perceived as the non-intelligent client.
Yeah.
But I think basically what they were trying to say was, you know, if you know what your organisation needs and you can articulate that to us, we've got a much better chance of being able to deliver that to you.
Yeah.
And we've got a better chance of being able to demonstrate that and report that. And I think half the problem that organisations have had hasn't been the cultural misalignment between them. It's been about the reporting. It's been that the FMs have done the job, but the perception is that they haven't.
Yeah.
And I think that's where technology can help, is demonstrate where tasks have been done, on time, how often, and what things are still outstanding. And no one wants to see, you know, pages and pages. What they want to see are the exceptions.
Yeah.
Where things haven't quite gone to plan. And actually, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
So, yes, I think technology in so many different ways it is going to sort of revolutionise what's going on in FM.
Yeah.
But only if we actually give it a chance.
Yeah.
You know, I still hear of organisations that, you know, I once said to a CAFM provider, I said, is your new business coming from your competitors? Or is it people that haven't actually used CAFM systems, you know, yeah, and are still on spreadsheets?
Yeah.
And they said, spreadsheets? We've got people that are doing it on paper. And I think that's the problem.
Yeah.
You know, forget artificial intelligence, you know, and systems that are going to sort of, you know, identify problems before they've even sort of identified themselves. Yeah. You know, you've still got people doing things on paper,
yeah,
and on spreadsheets and aren't using the technology to its full advantage. So in some ways, we've still got quite a long way to go.
Yeah, we see the exact same thing in the vending industry. So in the vending world, you have telemetry, and which is kind of the way the vending machines can communicate back to us. But then there's some of our competitors, other companies, that they literally use pen and paper to go and count what's in a vending machine and then fill it up kind of manually in the old-fashioned way.
How many paper cups are left? How many beans are left?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, actually, that machine can actually not only tell you where you are on your supplies,
yeah,
but actually with sensors tell you when it's going to break before it's broken.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's the really clever stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And it's an investment in technology that does cost, but the amount of money it saves you long-term, and it's kind of getting people's mindsets to shift a little bit and realise that actually this technology, in a lot of cases, you invest in it and it long-term, it saves you so much more money because it's everything's so much more efficient, so much faster. But it's getting the pen also, and papers
and,
to
and I think
move to technology.
There are now robotic or cobots, which are not just robots, but they work with humans. And
yeah,
I think the intrinsic difference is that what they're doing is they're cleaning areas that are very mundane and very routine and allowing cleaners. It's not replacing cleaners, it's in addition to cleaners.
Yeah, supporting them.
It's supporting them. So you're taking away the mundane tasks and allowing cleaners to clean the touch points that need to be cleaned more regularly, especially during COVID.
Yeah,
you know, anything that someone's touching needs to be cleaned far more effectively and efficiently and more frequently. And I think that also we've got a couple of problems. You know, we were talking earlier about what are the problems, and I think Brexit and COVID have been major problems for the sector.
Yeah,
you know, people have left because of those two things and gone back to Eastern Europe and haven't returned.
Yeah,
and I think we're failing to get frontline staff.
Yeah,
people don't want to come back and work here anymore.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to have to use more robots. In fact, I've recently been invited down to see Ocado. And not only are there robots picking groceries, they're also making food for the staff.
Oh, wow.
quite phenomenal.
Yeah. Wow. It's a crazy world, isn't it?
But you've got to have the scale to be able to utilise that and make that worthwhile to create that investment. I mean, however cool it is to see, It's got to create a return on investment.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be there at the expense of human beings.
No.
It should be there to free up human beings to do other things. And I think that's the fear of digitization and robotics, is that it's taking jobs away.
Yeah.
But actually, I'm not sure that it will. I'm sure it will just free people up to do different jobs.
Yeah. I agree. And I suppose the moving forward kind of FM companies it probably feels like a bit of a minefield to some of them. Like, what do we do first? What do we fix? Where do we go now? How can they move forward now in this post-COVID world?
I think they all need to differentiate themselves.
Yeah.
FM, as we said, it's a huge space.
Yeah.
Don't compete after everything. Cherry pick organizations and tenders that you think that you're going to excel at.
Yeah.
And do so and make yourself a little bit more niche in certain respects.
Yeah.
Not so niche that one thing happens and you can tumble. You need to spread the risk.
Yeah.
But I do think that you need to sort of, you know, have areas of specialism that you can, that you can quite easily demonstrate to people and that they will immediately turn to you because that's where your core competencies are.
Yeah. Yeah. Brilliant. Well, thank you, David.
Thank you.
So much has changed in the last couple of years, and the FM industry has had so much to contend with. It's time to move forward and get this vital part of the industry back on track. Thanks for your time. It is really good getting some input from the experts, so thank you.
Absolute pleasure.
This podcast has been brought to you by Refreshment Systems Limited, edited by Isaac Dunyo and Evan Church, produced by Steve May, host Jamie Cochran, with special thanks to our guest, David Emmanuel, and IFM.